nation will endure as it has endured, will revive and will prosper. So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance.
That recording of Franklin Roosevelt is from his first inaugural address. It's now an iconic tidbit from the first of four terms in office, but the backstories of that and his other speeches, and especially fireside chats, put Roosevelt's words in another light altogether, and that's what you get from author and journalist Terry Galway's Together We Cannot Fail. Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Terry Galway joins us today to talk about the book and accompanying CD of excerpts from 30 of Roosevelt's most famous speeches. Welcome to the show, Terry.
Hi, it's great to be there.
You know, one of the hallmarks of Roosevelt's speeches were that they were delivered in simple language, but they weren't simplistic. I read somewhere that in his fireside chats, 80% of the words he used were in the 1,000 most commonly used words in the English dictionary, yet you didn't feel talked down to at all.
No, that's right. Franklin Roosevelt really did know how to speak to every man and every woman. And the reason that was important is that Franklin Roosevelt was—he wasn't the first media presidency, because you know, media changes through the centuries, but he was the first radio president. And of course, you know, radio was the great mass medium of the late 20s, and then of course throughout the 30s and 1940s. So every time Franklin Roosevelt spoke on the radio, he was speaking to more Americans than ever heard a president before in the entire life of the nation.
At one time.
Mm-hmm. At one time, right, right.
Did he understand the impact of that at the time?
I think he did. I think he understood, in the same way that Ronald Reagan understood the importance of sound bites and visuals in 1980, I think that Roosevelt understood the importance of radio. Now, I've not ever read any kinds of letters or any sort of correspondence where he says, hey, let's take advantage of radio. I've got a great voice. But he probably didn't have to.
He actually started doing fireside-like chats as the governor of New York.
That's right. That's right. He used the radio as governor. And I think that one of the more neglected areas of Roosevelt's studies, and it certainly is an entire field, but one of the more neglected portions of Franklin Roosevelt's career is his 4 years as governor of New York, because it's there that you see him testing out things that he will do in the New Deal, both as in terms of policy, in terms of the way he governed, and certainly in terms of the way he communicated with the voters.
Of course, back then, if you were governor of New York, you were considered an obvious candidate in the future for the president.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, New York was the powerhouse. I guess, certainly California is the powerhouse today. And I guess if you're governor, except if you're not born in the United States, if you're governor of California, you're considered presidential material, the current governor accepted, of course. But that power in New York led to the 1944 election, which saw a New York governor, a former New York governor, Franklin Roosevelt, running against the current New York governor, Thomas Dewey. So you had two New Yorkers running for president in 1944. And after that, or sort of after 1948, New York's power begins to dissipate.
You wrote that delivered in a harsher tone, the words of Roosevelt's first inaugural address, the ones we just heard, could have sounded like a demagogue's diatribe. But in his patrician tone, the demand for greater power, which he asked for in that speech, sounded like action. And the indictment of the old order sounded like justice.
That's right. Did I write that? That sounds great.
Yeah, it was very well done, and I copied it word for word.
I thought it sounded familiar. I think that's so. I think that, Americans heard in his voice something that was not threatening and not scary. For example, The previous Democratic nominee for president was Al Smith, who was nominated in 1928. He was the first Catholic ever to be nominated. And while Al Smith was not a scary individual by any means, if you hear his speeches, and there are some of them, I think, that you can probably access on the internet. I mean, Al Smith sounds like a guy from the Lower East Side of Manhattan with a really, I'm afraid to say harsh because I have a New York accent myself, having grown up there. But you know, he sounded like a New Yorker, and in way, and I think that in this time where you didn't, you know, mass media was really just getting to catch on. I think that if Al Smith had said some of the things that Franklin Roosevelt said in 1932 or 1933, rather, I think it would have sounded a little scarier. But Franklin Roosevelt sort of spoke in this kind of Hollywood, you know, patrician accent that was common at the time. So I think that when he asks for more power and when he condemns the practices of the bankers, I think that it, you know, it didn't sound like you know, an American demagogue. And remember, this is a time, this is a period of time where you know, Mussolini has come to power in Italy, where Hitler has come to power in Germany. And
well, there's Father Coughlin and
Father Coughlin is out there in the United States, and Huey Long
right.
in Louisiana. So you've got these voices out there that are very threatening and scary. And Franklin Roosevelt, you know, said some very powerful things, but he was able to communicate that he was not, in fact, a sort of a wild-eyed radical, which he wasn't.
Just joining us, my guest is Terry Galway. He's the author of Together We Cannot Fail. The subtitle is FDR and the American Presidency in Years of Crisis. And, of course, you know, it, really his entire presidency, wasn't it?
Yes. It's amazing. When you think of the 12 years he spent, or 12-plus years as president, you know, every week, every day is spent either trying to bring the nation out of depression or trying to win a world war. I mean, I you know, there was never a day off. I mean, of course, he did get away, and of course he went to Warm Springs, where he you know, was hoping for a cure to his polio, or certainly you know, he would go away for periods of time. But what a relentless presidency his was.
Well, and then of course he ran for four terms too.
Yes, right.
I mean, running for office even back then was no walk in the park.
No, particularly for someone who couldn't walk. Okay. You know, which is something we often forget
about.
Didn't
think about that.
No, but I mean, think about it today. The idea of somebody, you know, we think of ourselves, I think, as a more open society, and we certainly make accommodations for those with disabilities. Let's face it, Franklin Roosevelt had a disability. He was paralyzed from the waist down. And the idea of we've broken many barriers, obviously, in society. But I wonder if a man or a woman in a wheelchair could win the presidency today.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it would be such a, I think what's more interesting, too, than anything, really, is that nobody really ever talked about it.
Yep. That's true. Well, you know why, though, I think, is because I do think that a lot of Americans were fooled. I think a lot of people believed that Franklin Roosevelt had somehow, he hadn't overcome polio, but that he had somehow he was able to walk. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he made a great show of standing at podiums. He made a great show at several conventions of, quote-unquote, walking out to the podium, when, in fact, all he was doing was swiveling his hips while holding a cane in one hand and having his arm on somebody else in the other. But what he learned was that he had this magnificent smile, and he learned that if he, you know, I think many Americans have this image in their heads of Franklin Roosevelt with his head tilted back and this great big smile. And guess what? That's what people looked at. They didn't look at what was going on, you know, below his waist, where he, you know, had these huge braces on and, in fact, wasn't walking. He was just shuffling.
He also had them riveted by the topics of the day, which when he first took office, of course, was the Depression, right in the thick of it. And we have a cut right now from his first fireside chat on the banking crisis. Why don't we hear that right now?
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
My friends, I want to talk for a few minutes with the people of the United States about banking, to talk with the comparatively few who understand the mechanics of banking, but more particularly with the overwhelming majority of you who used banks for the making of deposits and the drawing of checks. I want to tell you what has been done in the last few days and why it was done and what the next steps are going to be.
You know, they could, like, replay that in every sixth grade class in the country today, and it still would clear up a lot of misconceptions about what a bank is.
Exactly. And, you know, he was speaking to an audience, of course, which, you know, is not as sophisticated as we are today, although, of course, we were led down the primrose path. But he was, you know, the people weren't concerned about their 401ks back then. They were concerned about their bank account, you know, very basic stuff. And in this speech, from the clip is so terrific because I think it really encapsulates why Roosevelt was so popular. I mean, I remember my grandparents telling me in the 1960s that Franklin, when Franklin Roosevelt seemed to be speaking to them, that was the sort of intimacy that Franklin Roosevelt was able to establish with the American people. And I think that you can, even in that brief clip that you just played, you can hear he's talking directly at people. He's saying, you know, I'm talking to you, you know, and I understand your concerns. Yes, there are the small minority of people who understand banking, but and of course he was one of them. But now I'm going to explain to you that, and he goes on to say, for example, that you know banks take their the deposits of depositors and they invest them. It's not as though the bank, you know, has that cash right there. And you know, of course, the other person who explained it that way was Jimmy Stewart in It's a Wonderful Life. At one point, you know, there's a run on his bank, and he has to explain to people, no, you see, the money that you gave me, I then helped.
I thought about that.
Yeah, I helped so and so buy a house. It's your money is in her mortgage, and this and that, and it's quite wonderful, and that's sort of what Franklin Roosevelt was trying to describe. I wonder if the screenwriters of It's a Wonderful Life had that in mind, that first fireside chat, because that's kind of what Roosevelt was doing.
And I definitely thought of that last night when I was listening to the speech and also, you know, reading about it in your book, Together We Cannot Fail. He had a way of imbuing his speeches to the public like that with this sort of empathy. And more than anything, it was very authentic. Now, this is sort of the disconnect with his disability. Most people didn't really understand it and know to what effect it had polio had crippled him. But it was maybe that itself that made him so authentically empathetic.
Well, a lot of FDR scholars, and I'm not one, I think I'm becoming one, but a lot of FDR scholars do seem to see a change in his personality after polio, that he became a lot more empathetic, a lot more understanding of the common man. Because remember, Franklin Roosevelt, you know, was born into privilege, lived in privilege his whole life, you know, grew up in the Hudson Valley in New York to an aristocratic Dutch family, and for the most part, for the early years of his career, he was considered in New York politics a lightweight, you know, someone who really, you know, was just getting by on good looks and his name and his connections to the other president, Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt's cousin, and using his connections in the big WASP establishment to get, you know, good jobs. After polio, many FDR biographers seem to think that he became a much more serious person. He understood and was much more sympathetic with the everyday problems of people. And his wife, Eleanor, of course, also served as his conscience in that regard. So I think that having been through what he went through, I mean, a devastating illness, I think he was able to exude that genuine sense of sympathy and understanding, and I think that people interpreted it that way too. And you're right; they may very well have understood. Well, here's a guy. I mean, he knows what he thought. He knows what it's like to struggle.
We have to take a quick break. My guest is Terry Galway. He's the author of "Together We Cannot Fail: FDR and the American Presidency in Years of Crisis." 614-292-8513. If you have a question or comment, this is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
The business of war is sometimes like organized crime, according to investigative reporter Aram Rostin. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about his article, How the U.S. Funds the Taliban. He says the U.S. military's contractors in Afghanistan are forced to pay suspected insurgents to protect American supply routes. His story prompted a House subcommittee investigation. Join us.
Fresh Air begins at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. 31 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:21. Sunshine today, we're on our way to a high of 40 degrees. A few clouds this evening, a slight chance of rain, maybe a little freezing drizzle after midnight, a low of 31. Clouds and a chance of rain on Friday, but a warm day again, a high of 40 degrees. Partly sunny on Saturday and a high of 41. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Governments can err. Presidents do make mistakes. But the immortal Dante tells us that divine justice weighs the sins of the cold-blooded and the sins of the warm-hearted in different scales. There is a mysterious cycle in human events. To some generations, much is given. Of other generations, much is expected. This generation of Americans has a rendezvous with destiny.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Terry Galway. He wrote a book. It's called Together We Cannot Fail, FDR and the American Presidency in Years of Crisis. And, of course, that's another the rendezvous with destiny speech, another, a phrase that's as common as anything in the United States today.
Yes, and one that was adapted by President Reagan, who said the same thing about another generation of Americans, and I think he said that in 1980, certainly, obviously in the 1980s, I think in the early 80s, again, at a time, and some of us may remember that the early 80s were not such good times either, and to even speak of a rendezvous with destiny in the early 80s would seem unbelievably optimistic, and likewise with Roosevelt in 1930. He's giving that speech is from the 1936 Democratic Convention. While the Depression has eased somewhat, unemployment at that time is still about 17% as opposed to 25%. So to speak to this weary nation still in the throes of an economic catastrophe and to say that we have rendezvous with destiny, well, you know, that was pretty optimistic too. And that is one thing I think that's, by the way, that keeps that sort of Franklin Roosevelt and Ronald Reagan, seemingly ideological opposites, one thing that unites them is that sense of optimism.
Which he learned early on from one of his teachers in, boarding school in Groton?
At Groton, yes, that's right. He often referred to his instruction there as giving this optimistic faith. And he was an optimist. Listen, only an optimist could have said to himself, as he did, after being given the diagnosis of polio, of then deciding, well, I can still, you know, have a wonderful career and a wonderful life and be president of the United States. A pessimist would not have come to that conclusion.
You know, the speech as it goes on is notable in many ways for its militant tone at that point. But something happened just before he took the podium that night that he later described as the most frightful 5 minutes of his life.
Right, that was when he fell.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and he was paralyzed. I mean, he fell, and the pieces of his speech scattered all over the place. And you know, he was mortified. He was embarrassed. He was frightened. And you know, there was that concern of his, which he lived with every day, that he would be trapped in a fire. You know, I think there's some correspondence about that, and you know, I think he articulated that, not in public, but that was one of his great fears, is that, you know, he really was helpless in that regard, and that was exactly how he felt before he gave that speech, which may have given a little bit of an edge, because that speech is very strong in condemning bankers and the finance system. Roosevelt was much more tougher rhetorically on Wall Street and the bankers than Barack Obama has been.
Yep. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. If you want to share some memories of your listening pleasure to the Franklin D. Roosevelt, give us a call, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Jerry, you're on the air.
Oh, good morning, Ms. Fisher, Mr. Garway. Great book. Lived through the entire 12 years. The bankers hated him, and he says, I embrace their hatred.
That's right, he did. He said that in 1936, as a matter of fact, right?
And I hadn't heard his voice described as patrician in many a decade, and Ms. Fisher brought that out. And I also, the older I get, and the more I wonder, how the dickens did this man ever get elected because of his polio? He had a 10-pound weight on each leg. But what I would like to address, if I may, is the fact that he did not ever show any animosity toward those of the opposite party. For example, in 1940, he appointed Frank Knox as Secretary of Navy. Who was Frank Knox? Ran for vice president with Al Flanden in 36. In the same year, he appointed Henry L. Stimson, a conservative Republican, as Secretary of War. Whoop, I shouldn't say that. That's politically incorrect. But it didn't seem to make any difference to FDR. And most young people today, even middle-aged people, even probably people in their 60s, don't appreciate all of the things like the CCC, Civilian Conservation Corps, the WPA, and the Tennessee Valley Authority, where people that didn't even have electricity were able to get electricity, and all of these things. And I've got to get your book. I've read and heard a lot, and as I say, lived through those times. And FDR, I don't know, I heard recently, I don't know where I must have seen it, someplace, that he was the outstanding figure of the 20th century worldwide. Now, are you aware of that?
I'm not aware of it, but I'm not surprised.
Yeah, because, look, he had this lend-lease.
Jerry, you're stealing the show.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, I'm of our conversation already.
I'm sorry. I lived through that.
I know it. I know.
And, you know, it just brings back so many memories.
Did you listen to his fireside chats?
Oh yes, very definitely.
Which is the most memorable one for you?
Oh gosh, I think probably the one where he says this generation has a rendezvous with destiny. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, by the way, his enemies, you know, I don't know if this is in your book, but they wouldn't even call him by name. They said, quote, that man in the White House.
That man. Yes, that man. Exactly right. Yes.
Which was almost a compliment in a way, wasn't it?
Oh, right. Absolutely. And FDR looked out for, quote, the forgotten man. Minimum wage was passed in 38, 25 cents an hour. And by the way, the unemployment was 25% in March of 33. And it had gone down to 10% by 34 years. And I get a kick out of the media, but it's 10%, 10%.
Wow.
Terrible.
Everything's relative. So.
Yeah.
Jerry, thanks for your call.
Oh, thank you very much. Appreciate the program.
You
thank
bet. You.
It's an interesting point that he brings up about this sort of non-rancorous debate. I mean, Franklin Roosevelt did, in fact, appoint those two Republicans to his cabinet in 1940. He's absolutely right, and he might have added, and I'm sure would have, Wendell Willkie, who ran against him in 1940. By the time the war comes in 1942, when he appoints Wendell Willkie as the – doesn't appoint him, but he sent Wendell Willkie to Winston Churchill as his personal representative. And for a period of time, he was talking about running a Roosevelt-Wilkie ticket in 1944, a Democrat and a Republican, but Wilkie died, so we'll never know whether that would have happened.
But in those days, there was an actual moderate, a pretty large moderate
Yes, that's true. But if you got Franklin Roosevelt talking about some other Republican, mm-hmm. I have to tell you, Senator Taft would be one of them.
Mr. Republican.
Yeah, yeah. He was perhaps not as amiable towards Senator Taft in the late 30s, early 40s, as the confrontation in Europe was coming to a head. There was a partisan edge to Franklin Roosevelt, and you hear that in some of his speeches, and you certainly saw it in 1944 when he would sort of, these Republican critics, mm-hmm. you know. So, yes, I think things were less bitter than they are today, but there was still a little bit of a racist
sure.
edge.
We have another cut. It's his address to Congress requesting the declaration of war. He dictated this speech to his secretary, and it's kind of interesting how that turned out. Why don't we listen to that now?
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. I ask that the Congress declare that since the unprovoked and dastardly attack by Japan on Sunday, December 7th, 1941, a state of war has existed between the United States and the Japanese Empire.
That was an address to Congress requesting declaration of war on December 8th, 1941. He dictated that speech to his secretary, Grace Tully. Terry, that was unedited by anybody else. He usually is very collaborative, but in this case, he did it all himself.
That's right, including the phrase, the date that will live in infamy, mm-hmm. which, like Rendezvous with Destiny and any number of phrases, you know, have become part of American lexicon. And there is an original copy of the speech at the FDR Library, which I saw about a year ago, where I forget what the original phrase was, but you can see in Roosevelt's handwriting where he changed December 7th to a date which will live in infamy. The previous phrase was very clunky and prosaic and not something we would remember in 2010. But sure enough, Roosevelt was a master of that. And, you know, Roosevelt, like John Kennedy, and to some extent like Ronald Reagan, but certainly like John Kennedy, Roosevelt considered himself a writer. I mean, mm-hmm. he was the editor-in-chief of the Harvard Crimson, which is the Harvard newspaper. Listen, I was a journalist for 30 years. I'm not sure that editing the Harvard Crimson makes you a journalist, but it's better than not. It's better than not, right. But he would often tease the reporters by saying, you know, back in my newspaper days, you know. I think he did have a certain amount of pride of authorship with his speeches, as Kennedy did and certainly as Ronald Reagan did. And, you know, not surprisingly, the three people I've just mentioned happen to be among the greatest communicators in, you know, our modern history. And I think that's because they understood that words are important. And it's funny, Reagan, of course, is more considered to be an image president, but he was very much a president of words as well. And he had that in common, like I said, with Franklin Roosevelt.
The speech was just 6 minutes long in that case. His longest was about 45 minutes. Was length part of his style? Did you see any patterns?
I didn't. I think he had a good sense that he shouldn't talk for very long.
Uh-huh.
In his lifetime, it was not unusual for presidents or politicians to go on and on and on. He didn't. It certainly, again, he was president long before the idea of a soundbite was theorized, but I think he understood that it was important to get to the point. Again, more than any other president, before him, he was speaking to the masses. You know, every other president, including Hoover, even though, you know, the radio was around when Hoover was president, but he wasn't a radio president. And every other president before, the way they spoke to the masses is they gave a speech to a few thousand people, and it was reported in the newspapers the next day. And then you read the text, but you didn't hear the president's voice. And I think, as Franklin Roosevelt showed, you know, the voice, the pitch, the demeanor of how you deliver a speech is nearly as important as what you say.
And he didn't want the newspaper people tinkering with it either.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, get it straight
not
to
him. They would, of course.
No, they never would, no. you're talking to another newspaper person,
okay.
Terry, 27 years. The publication of the book seems well-timed, given the economic upheaval in recent years, and you mentioned Barack Obama earlier and his messages and how they contrast and compare.
Right. Well, I think that Obama has been – I think, you know, and people may disagree, but I think Obama has been very gentle, I think, in his criticisms of Wall Street and the economic, the people he perhaps holds responsible for the economic catastrophe that we are, you know, only now maybe emerging from. And I think that, you know, anyone who disagrees with me, and people might, should buy the book. By two, and listen to Franklin Roosevelt and listen to the edge in his speeches when he talks about the malefactors of great wealth and the crimes of incompetence committed by Wall Street during the, you know, in the lead up to the Depression. He is very tough on the finance industry of 1920s, really, because that's what he's criticizing, the practices mm-hmm. of the 20s, in ways that Obama has not been. And it could be because Obama is a more embracing figure or a less divisive figure, or because of many factors he believes he can't be as divisive as Roosevelt was. But there's no question that Roosevelt was pointing fingers in 1933 and all the way, I would say, to 1938.
You know, it was a huge leap to radio in those days. But, of course, who can conceive and how it might impact Barack Obama with the Internet, with Twitter, with, you know, everything, you know, that's out there now, this immediate communication. Everything he says is immediately dissected, not just him, but anyone in his position.
Yes. And I think something has been lost there because, you know, when was the last time? And I'm not even sure. My memory is failing me here, but I don't recall seeing President Obama giving a primetime address to the nation from behind his desk at the Oval Office. Yes, he's given, you know, he's going to give the State of the Union speech shortly, and I think he's given a few speeches here and there.
He did the one at West Point.
I mean, he's given some memorable speeches, but the idea, and this, of course, was not so much Franklin Roosevelt as Ronald Reagan, the idea of a set-piece presidential speech behind his desk at the Oval Office explaining to the country what policy or what pronouncement he's – what direction he's going to lead the country, that I think has been lost in this alleged communications revolution. And I think that's not good. I think that there was and has been this wonderful tradition, which Roosevelt started, of mass communication to the American people, where the American people stopped what they were doing – put away the distractions and listen to the President of the United States. You know, there were occasions for Roosevelt's fireside chats. I mean, there was a buildup to them. You know, they weren't spontaneous, not all of them anyway. And there were several fireside chats where movie theaters closed, restaurants closed, so patrons could go home and listen to the radio to hear what the President of the United States has to say.
There'd be riots in the streets today.
Absolutely. Can you imagine? So I think Obama could take a page from Franklin Roosevelt and from Ronald Reagan to try, at least, to get people to pay attention for an hour a month, you know, mm-hmm. to a presidential speech. And, it's just not happening. And I think that's unfortunate because Obama is surely one of the great communicators. That's the reason he's president, is that he was a wonderful communicator. And I wonder if that skill has been lost amid all of the other stuff that you Twitter and all this mm-hmm. other stuff, because that's a different media entirely. And I'm not sure how good that is to get a mass message out to people, particularly in times of national peril. And surely this is a time of national peril, both, you know, from a national mm-hmm. security standpoint and from an economic standpoint.
We have to take a quick break. My guest is Terry Galway. He's the author of Together We Cannot Fail. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
The business of war is sometimes like organized crime, according to investigative reporter Aram Rostin. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about his article, How the U.S. Funds the Taliban. He says the U.S. military's contractors in Afghanistan are forced to pay suspected insurgents to protect American supply routes. His story prompted a House subcommittee investigation. Join us.
Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820, NPR News. Be sure to catch Art Scene, Columbus's monthly art show, anytime online at wosu.org/artscene. On this month's show, go behind the scenes at Ballet Met's The Nutcracker. See the art of quilts at the newest exhibition at the Rife Gallery, and get to know the artists of soul art from the National Afro-American Museum and Cultural Center. Art Scene gives you a firsthand look at the arts in action in Columbus. Online at wosu.org/artzine. 31 degrees in downtown Columbus, on our way to a high of 40 degrees with sunshine today. A few clouds this evening and a slight chance of rain, maybe a little freezing drizzle after midnight. The low will be 31. Clouds with a chance of rain for Friday and a high of 40 degrees. And looking ahead to Saturday, partly sunny and a high of 41. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
My fellow Americans, last night when I spoke with you about the fall of Rome, I knew at that moment that troops of the United States and our allies were crossing the channel in another and greater operation. It has come to pass with success thus far. And so, in this poignant hour, I ask you to join with me in prayer. Almighty God, our sons, pride of our nation, this day have set upon a mighty endeavor, a struggle to preserve our republic, our religion, and our civilization, and to set free a suffering humanity.
Okay, that was Franklin Roosevelt on June 6, 1944, and he's asking the nation to pray with him. My guest is Terry Galway. He's the author of the book Together We Cannot Fail. And by the way, all of these recordings are on a CD that comes with the book. It's kind of how the book is structured. The CD is structured and done in such a way to follow through the book. Terry, why a prayer in that case? Why do you think?
Well, it is interesting because I can't remember any time recently where a president has asked the nation to join him in a prayer. Obviously, there is a place for prayer in the public sphere. We have this notion of church, separation of church and state, and obviously we know about controversies about prayer in public schools and such. But of course, what's interesting at ceremonial occasions, including the inauguration of a president, including the opening of the House of Representatives and the Senate, every day there's a prayer. In Roosevelt's case, of course, June 6, 1944 was D-Day. It was the Allied invasion of France, the beginning of the end of the Nazis. And I think that it was such a poignant hour. I mean, hundreds of thousands of American troops, tens of thousands of American troops landed in France on D-Day, which meant that there were hundreds of thousands of family members who were wondering how their sons, daughters, fathers, mothers, et cetera, were doing. So in Roosevelt's case, it was not a moment for declaring victory, declaring mission accomplished, because there was no telling when he spoke about whether the landings actually would wind up succeeding. You'll notice in that speech he says that they have met with success thus far. He had no way of knowing whether they would continue to meet with success. So in his view, it seemed only appropriate to reflect and to pray for those who would set free a suffering humanity, as he said.
It focused on the reality of war, its horrors.
Yes.
He didn't sugarcoat any of that.
And he did not.
He acknowledged that many would not return.
Yes, he did. I remember hearing recordings of that speech when I was 13 years old in 1969. I remember thinking that, because I was during Vietnam, and I remembered thinking, I wasn't 13, I was older than that, but because I was beginning to think, would I have to serve in Vietnam? And I actually did have a draft card a few years later. But I remember thinking that there was a portrait of war that you don't often hear from commanders in chief. It's not about glory. It's not about martial achievement. He talked about the inevitability of large casualties, and which, of course, they were. And he talked, as you said, very candidly about the realities of what war meant. And I remember thinking that Lyndon Johnson had spoken that way. Well, that's another story entirely.
Right. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Doug, you're on the air. You want to talk about how Roosevelt used his great communicating skills to unite Congress about the war.
Right, and the politics of the day regarding war, I don't know if how much the Republicans in Congress supported the war after Pearl Harbor and before, but I know they were, they claim that, the Democrats were the war party, and just take it from there, please. Mm-hmm. And I look forward to getting your book.
Oh, well, thank you. It's an interesting question you raise. There was in the Republican Party an isolationist wing that was centered in the Midwest, and one of its champions, of course, was Ohio's Robert Taft. And until Pearl Harbor, there was hope that the United States would not enter the war. Now, bear in mind that the isolationists have gotten come in for a tough time, from history. But I think it is important to remember that these isolationists did remember the disillusion that followed World War One. Mm-hmm. America went to Europe to make the world safe for democracy, and how did that work out? Right, you had Hitler in Germany, you had the generals in Japan, and you had the communists in Moscow. Didn't work out so well. So there was this real sense that Europe was hopeless, and there was we would be wasting American lives. What the isolationists didn't see was the intrinsic evil of Nazism and Hitler, and that made all the difference. That this was not, in fact, another war among empires. So after the war, I would say, it was the beginning of this bipartisan American foreign policy that existed right through the 1960s. The Republicans really didn't cause any sort of trouble. In fact, the person who caused the most trouble during the war was Harry Truman, because Harry Truman was the chairman of a committee that was looking into war profiteering and poor materiel and basically business practices during the war. And the Truman Committee made Harry Truman's reputation because he was a Democrat, and he looked into war profiteering, as I said, and all sorts of abuses by war contractors, and came in for a lot of criticism.
We have an email from Bob. He wonders, to what extent do you think that FDR's greatness was constructed by the citizenry who desperately needed it? That he needed a leader. So how much do people read into what he said versus him maybe, for lack of a better word, manipulating them?
Well, that's a pretty good question. There's no doubt that the United States needed a champion, needed somebody to make him feel better. That's part of the commander-in-chief's job. And yes, the United Americans put their hopes in Roosevelt and maybe did, in a way, construct this heroic image which he continues to have. And, you could make the same argument for Ronald Reagan.
Sure.
And actually for many of the presidents we revere. We've got this construction of Abraham Lincoln and this construction of George Washington. Who knows how much that really bears on reality.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Roosevelt's words speak for themselves. I really do. There's not a whole lot. I don't think there's not a whole lot of guile there. As you suggested before, he used very simple language, and was speaking directly to the people. And, you know, he was evasive on certain things. I mean, in 1940, he gave a speech where he said America hates war, which I happen to believe, and he did too, and that America hopes for peace, and therefore American soldiers would never go to Europe. He was running for re-election at the time. That was manipulation. You know, I mean, surely he believed that the United States would have to enter World War II. And by 1940, the United States was virtually an ally of Great Britain as it fought, Germany, Nazi Germany. So, you know, there's some rhetorical fast and loose language in Roosevelt's speeches. But I think the point is well taken that, you know, we construct the heroes we need. Ask some of our sports stars.
In the chapter regarding his second fireside chat, you talked about how much mail he received after his radio broadcasts.
Yes.
Did that practice endure throughout his tenure in office?
Yes. Yeah. Again, it speaks to the connection, the intimate connection that the American people had with Franklin Roosevelt. And there's a wonderful book, and far be it from me to plug somebody else's book, but there's a book about this topic. It's written by Lawrence Levine, and I'm blanking on the title, though it's in my bibliography. And it is specifically about the mail. It's not about Roosevelt. It's about the people who wrote to Roosevelt, and the amount of mail after every speech, particularly the fireside chats, was enormous. And, you know, I don't know. It's much easier these days, of course, to send an email to the White House than it would be to, you know, write a letter by hand for most of them and postmark it. And these are from ordinary people. But I wonder if the White House gets as many emails after a speech as Roosevelt got as, you know, letters. I'd be very interested in that because I suspect that Roosevelt got more letters after some of these fireside chats than any president in the, you know, internet age has gotten emails after a particular speech. I could be wrong about that, but it would be interesting.
Did you read the mail?
I read through some, actually, by reading the Levine book.
Okay.
I read many excerpts. It's a wonderful book if you're interested in how people perceived Roosevelt. So I read a lot of excerpts that were in that book.
Were his speeches as popular at the end of his life as they were at the beginning of his first term?
I think because of the war, the answer is yes. I think there still was this urgency that, here was the president speaking about, American troops overseas. I would say that the audience for any speech that might have been related to domestic policy, that the urgency was not there anymore. And he didn't give many of them. But I think that he still had, you know, the United States, the Americans had constructed this heroic image of Franklin Roosevelt so that every time he got on the radio, it was literally a living icon speaking to you. Now, again, the topic, the interest probably ranged. I'm sure that in 1940, on June 6, 1944, when he addressed the country on D-Day, I mean, I can't imagine somebody not listening to that speech. But if he gave a speech about a routine political speech when he was running for re-election in 1944, I suspect that the interest level would not have been as high. You're right.
We had some help on this, and I think the Levine book, was it called The People and the President?
That's it. Very good. Well done.
Okay, great. Thank you, Tyler. The next recording, we're going to squeeze one more in because I just thought it was funny and I liked it, comes from a campaign dinner address in September 1944, and it sort of brings to the fore his frequent companion at the time, not Lucy Mercer, but the Scotch Terrier Murray, the Outlaw of Fallow Hill, known as Falla. The Republicans had started a false rumor that Falla had been accidentally left behind in Alaska on the Aleutian Islands during a visit that August, and that Roosevelt, at the expense of the government, ordered a Navy destroyer back to Alaska to get Falla. This wasn't true, and he refers to it on September 23rd in an address before the Teamsters. Let's listen to that.
These Republican leaders have not been content with attacks on me or on my wife, or on my son. No, not content with that. They now include my little dog, Falla.
Oh,
course, I don't resent attacks, and my family don't resent attacks, but Fala does resent attacks.
Okay, it's even funnier than that. It goes on.
It is hilarious. It is hilarious. But, you know, it does speak. I mean, I know it's done, you know, in a very wonderful comic delivery, but there is an edge to that speech. You know, he mm-hmm. was very upset by Republican attacks, particularly Dewey's attacks. I mean, Dewey, at several occasions, you know, referred to the tired men in the White House. Oh, well. I wonder who he was talking about, you know. Mm-hmm. So he was bothered by that, and he used this wonderful device of talking about the criticisms of his dog when he was, of course, really talking about the criticisms of himself.
You know, you wrote in that chapter about that speech that the nation was listening to that, perhaps to hear if an aging and ailing Roosevelt still had what it took to lead the nation through the war's final stages.
Right.
How did he do?
Well, he did spectacularly well. I mean, previous to this, he had given a speech aboard a ship while he was actually on this trip to the Aleutian Islands and elsewhere. And the speech was a disaster. I mean, he lost his place and he almost fell. And the speech had no energy behind it. And people, I don't know how, the audience for that may have not been as large as normally was, but the newspaper coverage of that speech was devastating, and Time Magazine and other outlets were wondering out loud if Roosevelt had the energy to make it through another 4 years. And so, to me, the comparison is, for those of you who might remember, when Ronald Reagan had that disastrous appearance debate with Walter Mondale, where he lost his place and seemed to be forgetting things. Mm-hmm. And then we all tuned into the next debate to see if he would do any better. And I think that's an exact comparison. People tuned into the Fala speech, which was delivered in Washington to the Teamsters Union, to see if the old guy still had it. And guess what? He did.
My guest is Terry Galway. He is the author of Together We Cannot Fail, FDR and the American Presidency in Years of Crisis. It includes a CD of Franklin Roosevelt's most famous fireside chats. Terry, what was your favorite? Do you have one?
I have two. Okay. I think that the D-Day prayer, which we heard, I think is particularly poignant. I suppose it's my father-in-law is a D-Day veteran, and I've always, as a kid, you know, learned about D-Day, read about D-Day, and I think that's such an important point in American history. And the Fala speech. I mean, how could you not like the Fala speech?
Like
it's hilarious, you know, and it shows a side of Roosevelt that you didn't see too often. I mean, most of these speeches are about job losses and war and other catastrophes, and here he finally has a chance to show off his wit, and he does it in wonderful fashion.
You know, when folks set out to write a book like this, you know, obviously they know a lot about what they're talking about, but there's also that sense of discovery. And what did you discover that from doing this? We only have about a minute left.
Well, what I discovered is that Roosevelt really had tremendous input into writing his speeches, and that came as a surprise to me. I mean, I knew that, you know, John Kennedy and Ronald Reagan both had tremendous input into their speeches, and again, they both were terrific speech makers and have coined phrases that we still use today. But I had no idea of the extent to which Roosevelt took a lot of pride in his own writing. And no, of course he had speech writers. He had wonderful mm-hmm. speech writers, but he was a pretty darn good writer himself.
Okay, thanks a lot, Terry, for joining me today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I love the topic, and I love speaking to you about it.
This is Terry Galway. He is the author of Together We Cannot Fail, FDR and the American Presidency in Years of Crisis. And you've been listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus, and streaming on the web at wosu.org, WOSU 820, NPR News.